Good morning. So, how's life going under our new restrictions? Knuckling down and breathing deep, or fidgeting with the net curtains and wondering just how far you can push it?
It's 8 minutes after the ship in a storm on Great Uncle Phineas's grandfather clock, and I'm joined on the line by Garda Deputy Under Commissioner Fecla McGillifehickle.
Hello.
And tell us, how many checkpoints are out there this morning?
Well, in pursuant to the relevant subsection of the applicable directive, I cannot reveal the actual number.
It's too early for this. What can you say about checkpoints?
Well, Gordy, heretofore dispatch and jurisdictional operations are now working at capacity to deal with the challenges this...
And are these real checkpoints or the kind of ones you make up afterwards for the report?
Smart bucko. By and large, and notwithstanding, these are real checkpoints, mostly. Yeah. We also have Gordy in areas which we've identified as being at high risk of breaching the restrictions.
Yes?
Like housing estates with a lot of trampolines in rear gardens.
Not all heroes wear capes. Go back to the vehicle checkpoints. What are you looking for there?
Citizens should only be travelling in order to provide essential services.
Frontline medical staff, people working in supermarkets and so on?
Also farmers travelling to marts to shout over fences and spit in their hands, Chinese takeaways, and discount stores that specialise in hen party accessories and phone chargers that break the second time you use them.
Vital, one and all. And how do you check these motorists' bona fides?
They're what now?
How can you tell if their reasons for travelling are legitimate?
We're stopping people and asking them to provide proof of address, such as being able to point in the general direction of where they live and sounding confident when they say it's up the road there.
Right.
And if we still have doubts, we reserve the right to make them pinky promise.
Draconian. Are Gardaí travelling outside the 2 kilometre radius?
Only for work-related reasons and the procurement of vital supplies.
So picking up a snack box is an essential service?
For operational reasons, I cannot confirm or deny that, but yes.
Right. Now, I understand that measures are being implemented that will allow Gardaí arrest people in breach of social distancing protocols.
Though at the moment we are operating in a cautionary capacity only.
Right, so you can issue cautions?
No, we can urge people to take it handy, mind how they go, and in extreme circumstances, to cop the feck on.
The country breathes a sigh of relief. It's 12 minutes after the ship now, which means it's sundown somewhere. Which means... time for a break. For operational reasons.
The hardest working man in radio this week. That was Oliver Callan with Callan's Kicks from yesterday. However, as we came to terms with life in lockdown, just how these restrictions might be enforced gave rise to quite the ding-dong on the Brendan O'Connor show. John O'Keefe is a criminologist and editor of the Garda Review.
I have it on fairly good authority that some 250 prisoners from Mountjoy Prison, from the male wing, have been released early. And police in North Inner City Dublin are telling me this is already starting to cause some chaos. Now, this is anecdotal, but 250
is a health warning on that.
Absolutely. Yeah. But nonetheless, it is a lot that we know there are a lot of prisoners going to be released. And by the
because
way, they
the
were putting
the prison system is a worry here in
it
terms
is a worry,
of COVID-19.
But just on the criminal justice angle, these people were put in prison for a reason. So just letting them out, we can't all just suddenly say, well, it's OK, there's a pandemic. In one sense, you can, of course, because you must prevent its spread in prison. But on the other hand, the same criminal justice outcomes will potentially arise. So I think that's a real issue. The criminal justice system is going to slow up. I think one of the big issues here is, if I could just mention this point about this idea, we're hearing a little bit now on social media about human rights. We need to just park human rights for the moment and we need to talk about human lives. That's what this is all about, nothing else.
Park human rights?
Hang on.
And that is the voice of Professor Stephen Kinsella. Not impressed.
Park human rights? Did you really just say that?
Did that commentator just say we need to park human rights?
Human rights.
Human
defend
lives.
That statement, please, sir.
I'm quite happy to repeat it.
Defend your statement.
I will. When people's lives are at risk, as they clearly are at the moment, human rights, in the way we have been discussing them in Ireland over the last few years, have to become an adjunct issue until such time as we save our population.
Stephen Kinsella.
An adjunct issue. Really? Like, you really think that
human
like...
lives trump human rights? Yes, I absolutely do.
No, I think you're fundamentally, you know, you're The first part of your discussion was, you know, these people, who are allegedly being released, and then you're saying that we need to park human rights. Do you not think that in this society, that in a republic, that's not an acceptable statement to make?
It is in the context of what's going on at the moment. Nobody's saying we should forget human rights at any period, least of all now.
No,
what
you
I
are.
Am saying
that's what you just
it
did.
It takes priority. Human lives take priority. So if there are police checks all over Dublin, and by the way, I was stopped 3 times coming here today, some other people would have said my human rights were infringed. Well, you know what? I didn't mind it at all because I know what the end result is meant to be. That's what I'm talking about. What I don't want are people getting carried away with what they believe to be human rights issues, which quite frankly are subservient to human lives. That's
issues,
my point.
Issues such as what, John?
Well, such as what happened to me today, for example. I was stopped. I was asked questions. I wasn't asked for documents. I told them who I was. I told them where I was going, and that was fine. But there are some people who would find that offensive. What I'm saying is I don't find it offensive, and I think none of us should in the next while until we get over this pandemic.
Ooh, tense. Back to Stephen.
If you're in a situation where somebody chooses to deprive you of your liberty, and they do that based on a suspicion, and that suspicion turns out not to be true, and you have no recourse, and you're is that in your conception of things okay?
But Stephen,
because there's
a
pandemic,
are we not slightly all giving up some of our rights at the
moment?
No.
I have no issue with being asked about what my movements are at this particular point in time. My reaction was in hearing a statement that you simply have to suspend human rights. I just think that statement is far too far. And I don't think the other speaker has defended the position in any way. Actually,
okay,
he's given an example of being stopped in checks. Like that's not acceptable.
Professor Stephen Kinsella and John O'Keefe dropping the toast butter side down with Brendan O'Connor on Sunday. But just how compliant are we being? On Monday, Sean O'Rourke spoke to Professor Pete Lunn, head of the Behavioural Research Unit at the ESRI, and he brought us data mined from UCD. We're being pretty good so far, at least prior to the new lockdown measures, with 97% of us complying.
In fact, some of the data I've seen is even higher than that, with a substantial minority thinking that restrictions needed to go further at that time. So I think people's compliance is remarkable and their understanding of what's required of them is also quite remarkable. And we should respect that because, as I say, the news sees the extremes. The news sees the people who are not complying, but in fact, the large majority of people are. One wrinkle to that I would say that's quite interesting is we can see in the data that the people who are less likely to keep social distance on the various measures that we've used, it isn't only younger people in the sense of kind of youth and teenagers. Actually, compliance is somewhat better among anybody who's over 40 compared to the under 40s.
However, not everyone is being so obedient. Later that day on Liveline, Marianne phoned in to say that she and her 92-year-old husband had gone out for a drive.
Mm-hmm. And I took my 90-plus, he's 92 actually, year-old husband out for a drive just to see the daffodils in the middle of the road on the way out towards Enniskerry.
Okay.
And it was so stunningly beautiful. And then I actually went the extra lap to go, did the turn back to Enniskerry as if you're turning to Glendalough. I was stopped by some guards there.
Okay.
And they asked me what age I was, and I lied and said I was 70, which I'm actually 81 this year. So then I turned around, I said, I'm turning around now here. I did turn around, but to be honest, we went home via the scalp, which was so beautiful with all the gorse out and everything. And then when we were coming in towards Dundrum, we were stopped by a second Garda checkpoint.
Okay.
And the man said to me, he said, you know, you shouldn't be out.
Did he ask you what age you were?
He didn't ask me. No, I looked at me, probably knew what age I was.
Okay.
Anyway, so I
said, lying to a Garda once on, anyway, is bad enough. Yeah, I'm glad you didn't have to tell a fib twice.
Breaking the law. Well, Joe did not approve.
But if you, God forbid, had a little accident, You would have ended up in hospital. And that's the last place anyone over 70 wants to be
but
at the moment.
Why would I suddenly have an accident, Joe?
Because people in cars have accidents.
Yeah, but why would I suddenly have an accident now? I was driving very carefully.
I know,
there was actually nobody
but other
on the
people,
road.
There other
was the
people,
least accident
yeah,
prone.
But Marianne, other people might not have been driving carefully. But anyway, were you aware of the over 70 rule, I suppose, the way I'll come at it?
Well, my feeling was we were cocooned at home. We were now cocooned in the car.
But
so it was the same
but
situation.
Were you aware of the over 70 rule?
Well, I suppose I might have been.
You're very bright. You're playing bridge there with your other hand. You're very bright.
Marianne on Monday's Live Line. One person happily cocooning is David Norris. He spoke to Ray Darcy. And David's had health problems, but frankly, he's in his element.
I always like to go for the jackpot. You know, when I finally found out I had diabetes, it was supposed to be level 6. I was 27, and I thought, wow, I don't do anything by halves. And I'm actually in 3 at-risk categories.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because I'm 75,
right.
Which is old.
Ka-ching, right, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm a transplant survivor.
Ka-ching.
So I'm on immunosuppressant drugs.
Yes.
And I have diabetes.
Ka-ching.
So I really hit the jackpot again.
So you're staying out of people's way. Open to,
there are two wonderful things about it. First of all, I'm used to living on my own. Mm. And, as I told your researcher, I'm very good company. And secondly, I have a very big house.
Yes.
So I can actually go for a walk in the house. I mean, it's a mountain climb to get up to bed.
Yeah. So you're walking up and down the stairs, are you? Looking at all the portraits of yourself. Is that, that's
yes, there's about 20 of them now. You know, they are lovely, but you know, people give them to me, and I don't know where to put the bloody things. And when I'm dead, people are going to say, well, we always knew he was an egomaniac, but this is the end altogether.
And David Norris thinks that maybe, just maybe, there is an opportunity hidden beneath this crisis.
I really, really think that there's going to be a financial catastrophe after this. And it is another opportunity. We missed the last one. It's another opportunity to reorganise things economically and get rid of this kind of toxic vulture capitalism that's been going around, where vulture funds bought in, they didn't pay tax at all on the profits they made from evicting Irish people.
Yeah.
It's disgraceful. It should never have been allowed to happen.
Yeah, a lot of people are predicting a new world order. But we've short memories, you know, and you know, it looks to me like after the crash, and we thought that things were going to change forever, that things are back to the way they were before the crash. We didn't learn
much.
Yeah,
but this is a much bigger thing.
This is a much
bigger thing. I've never known anything like it. Never. Never, never, never.
David Norris. And another person cocooning is Eamon Dunphy. And he too has a view on how we might emerge from this whole experience.
We're going to realise the importance of the state as a protector of its citizens. And
and more importantly, I think, globally, you know, because this has to be fought at a global level.
Yeah, it's a threat to Europe, right? And the solidarity of the 27 nations that remain in Europe after the UK...
Why is it such a threat to Europe?
Because I think, you know, in France yesterday it emerged that the French had effectively stolen millions of face masks from a ship that was taking them to Italy and Spain. It's every man for himself, or
every country
for themselves.
Yeah.
Now, if Europe doesn't maintain some solidarity, both in health terms, but more importantly economically, through this period, well, then it's a threat to the European Union. It's certainly a threat to the euro. These are life-changing events, and I think the life-changing events have already begun.
Well, life-changing, that certainly can't be denied. That was Eamon Dunphy with Ray. And if you're just under the 70 wire, I do hope this isn't you.
We're hearing that people who are cocooning, and do you know, it's like 70 and over. So there are people of a certain age, let's say late 60s, who are delighted with themselves, and they're knocking on neighbours' doors who are over 70 going, hello, you're over 70. Maybe you need a little bit of help because you're elderly, obviously. I'll be here to help you. And they're kind of flaunting the fact that they can walk up on roads. You can just kind of picture them in, you know, the high-vis vest power people. In Ireland, they get a high-vis vest and they just go wild.
Ah, oh, the glories of the high-vis. And if you really want to irritate, just add a clipboard. Very few things you can't get away with then, trust me. Back in a bit. Welcome back. So, has grocery shopping become the new going out? An opportunity to get gussied up, ball gowns and aisle 12? Or maybe the bar is set a little lower and you're just aiming to get out of the cosies and maybe brush your hair? But most importantly, you get to leave the house. However, just what you should do with the bachelor's beans when you get home, wipe down or not to wipe down, that's the question. Here's Kim Roberts, Assistant Professor of Virology at Trinity College, with Sean O'Rourke.
If you'll excuse the phrase, there was a video that went viral in the past week by an American doctor talking people through how to safely unpack and decontaminate your grocery shopping. It's now had more than 20 million views in a few days. And Dr. Jeffrey Van Wingen in this video carefully decontaminates each item he's brought home from the shop with disinfectant spray and with soap and water. Many people will have seen it. So my first question is, what did you make of that video?
So my professional opinion is that whilst it's incredibly well-meaning, the video doesn't actually achieve what he sets out to. So he's wanting to decontaminate the groceries as he brings them in. But a lot of the time what he ends up doing is giving something a very cursory spray or wipe down with something. So with the kitchen spray that he's using. And that might not be enough if there really was a risk there. But my main message is that the risk of bringing the virus into your house from groceries is actually very low.
Well, that's encouraging news. So where is the biggest risk when you're doing your shop? Is it when you're actually in the shops or travelling to and from them, or when you get home?
So the risk is in the actual activity of doing your shopping. So if you're travelling on public transport, it's about trying to maintain that 2 metre distance from anybody else. If you're just walking around the corner, then of course that the risk is much lower. When you go into the shop, when you touch doors, when you touch freezers, when you touch the trolleys, those are all high touch surfaces that lots of people will have touched. And so there's a risk there. So when I go out shopping, I assume as soon as I leave my house that my hands are dirty. So I wash my hands before I leave so that they're as clean as possible. And then I step out my door and I assume that my hands are now dirty. So I don't touch my face and I touch as few things as possible. Now, when you're in the shop, the chances of a particular tin can that you're picking up or a particular box of cornflakes having a high enough amount of virus on them to cause a transmission event is really low. So those individual shopping items are not considered to be high risk for bringing virus into your house.
So virologists differ then. Well, on Morning Ireland, Cian McCormack was exploring the same dilemma on foot of newly published guidelines for shoppers and retailers from the Irish Global Health Network. Here is board member environmental health specialist Niall Roach, who is also adjunct assistant professor at the Centre for Global Health at Trinity College.
Before you go shopping, wash your hands.
And of course, deciding which hand to use.
Yes, I think practically for me, I'm a person who tends to touch my nose and mouth, and I'm always itching my nose. So trying to use your non-dominant hand to pick the goods up with and put it into your shopping basket or your trolley, or even if your own shopping bags yourselves, to avoid yourself having to touch a trolley or a basket.
But you also have after shopping guidelines. What are they?
Yeah, well, the first thing about after shopping, the first most important thing is that you wash your hands immediately after you return home. When you're bringing your shopping inside your own household, clear a designated area for your shopping, disinfect that area, wipe it down, and then stack your goods there in your shelves. And then after you've done your stacking, you can wash your hands again.
Would you clean off the surfaces of the individual items?
You may possibly want to do that. My understanding is that the risk is very low. If, for example, you're maybe buying packaged products like carrots in a bag, you may want to take the carrots out of the bag, not touching the carrots or not touching the outer covers of a yogurt packet, for example, put them in your bin, wash your hands, and then that you know that the products that you have not been handled or touched. But you may use an antiseptic on some packaging that you're going to have to be touching. But it's not, as I said, the risk is still regarded as low.
Dominant hands and antiseptic unloading area is yet another element to the shopping unpacking. But one thing we know for certain when it comes to this virus is that, well, nothing is certain. Back to Kim Roberts.
It's an uncomfortable reality that there are no certainties, that we are in a situation full of uncertainties. There are lots of things we don't know about the virus. The recommendations change every so often as we gain more information. So there are no absolute certainties. All we can do is assess the risk and then do what we can to reduce that risk.
But what about masks? Are they of any use in preventing either contracting or spreading the virus? On Thursday's Drive Time, Mary Wilson canvassed the views of Emeritus Professor of General Practice at Trinity College, Professor Tom O'Dowd, and KK Cheng, Professor of Public Health and Primary Care at the University of Birmingham. And while all agreed that hand hygiene and social distancing were key, they couldn't quite agree on a firm yay or nay on the mask etiquette. Here's Tom O'Dowd.
I think it's a difficulty for my public health colleagues because it has a plausibility. It seems to make common sense. But the danger is that it's introducing yet another variable in a society here where we're doing quite well. It may just cause difficulties. I heard Dr. Cormican today saying that, you know, exactly what you've said is the two main uses are if somebody has a COVID droplet infection or somebody who's looking after them, using face mask protection is clearly a good thing. Now, it's not a simple thing. Face masks are not a simple thing. And anybody who's worn face masks, the breath is very steamy and they do get wet. They need frequent changes and they need to be of good quality. And you need to be careful putting them on. You need to be careful putting them off. They need disposal afterwards. And you do need, you know, to wash your hands because if they're COVID positive, then you've got more problems.
And Professor KK Cheng?
I think people wear masks to protect themselves against infection. However, from a public health point of view, a better reason for doing so is actually to control the source of infection and protect others from droplets coming off our airways. This is especially important for coronavirus infection because a proportion of people are already infectious before they become symptomatic. So in a pandemic, and I stress really in a bad pandemic, you wouldn't do it in ordinary time. I wear a mask to protect you. You wear a mask to protect me. So everyone can be protected, but only if enough people do it. For this purpose, cloth masks are adequate. More sophisticated masks must be reserved for doctors and nurses.
Thursday's Drive Time. So, although the experts may differ on the efficacy of masks and other aspects of managing this virus, what cannot be denied is its devastating impact. The number of people dying from COVID-19 has increased dramatically, and the nature of their deaths is extremely distressing. On Monday, Kieran O'Rourke spoke to Joe Duffy. His mother, Anne, had died from COVID-19 at the age of 69.
Tell us, if you would, please, of how, because it came on very, very quickly, didn't it?
Yeah, we got a phone call on the Thursday to say that she contracted it, and they brought her to the hospital, and the hospital refused her because she was gone too far. So he brought her back to the nursing home where she was.
Okay.
And she died there alone, on her own, no one around her, no family, none of us were allowed in to see her or anything, you know.
So, and it was COVID-19.
I hope to call them out there yet. She said it was gone too far in the hospital, so she just brought back and she put us today just to make all the days.
And how long did she last for after she was brought back to the nursing home?
Not even 24 hours.
Okay. Tell us about your mum, Ciarán. She sounds, the little bit I've been hearing about her sounds, she's an incredible woman.
She wasn't. She was the pillar of the community. She really was. She'd done some more projects years ago for the kids. She was a community woman. You know, she came from an orphanage. She was an orphanage, an orphan girl. She came up from Longford and made a life for it, made a life for herself. But this went so hard, and she had two of her sisters, nieces, nephews. No, so she was just brilliant. She didn't deserve that, but she just didn't.
Ciarán O'Rourke speaking about his late mother, Anne. And later in the week, Joe spoke to Brendan Gleeson about the importance of the work being done in the hospice and how this crisis was impacting our experience of death and dying.
The thing that I wouldn't like to have to happen was that somebody belonging to me would have to die and you wouldn't be able to get to them. Or that you were in the similar situation and people weren't able to get to you. I mean, you can look through windows, you can do all sorts of things to alleviate it, but it just feels it's a dreadful disease that is robbing people of what I have been calling the gift of a good death since I got involved in the hospice. People might underestimate it, but for me it's a hugely important thing. So our heart goes out, you know, to all the people who have to go through it now.
However, Brendan did think there might be some small opportunity to find hope.
Some terrible tragedy happening here, so don't be all, you know, jolly hockey sticks about it. But I think it's an opportunity for us really just to recalibrate a small bit. Like, when we get together and get the thing, like, we're amazing people that can bring the country together. I think, I don't know of any other place that has stopped the curve to the same extent that we have.
Yeah,
like, and that's because we listen to what we're capable of doing what we're told. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody, you know, thinks nobody will do that if you'd ask them. Everybody's doing it, pretty much. And it's like, I think it's amazing what we're achieving. So I'm just hoping it's just reprioritizing for the right things and putting all those genius heads together. And all the people on the ground, I think the more people that they consult on the ground instead of sending away for experts, and tell people how things are working. Like, they're doing wonderful things here, and it's brilliant to see it. So, as I say, 2006 was then, this is now, and I prefer to look up and just think, there's nothing to stop us now. There's nothing to stop us. You know, this coronavirus, I don't know how long it's going to be, or I don't know anything about it, but it feels as if we're up to it, you know, in spite of all the tragedy that's going to happen. And I think we can just try and support the people who are going through that awful thing. I keep thinking the worst of it is, like, even though the numbers are small, I don't know what it is today, is it 85 or something it was, of people who have died. Like, it's the thought of dying alone, like, getting it back to the hospice a bit. The thing that I didn't feel with my mum, which I really feel blessed about, was that I didn't feel alone in my grief at all. I didn't feel she was alone in her death. And the horrible thing about this virus is that it's forcing that on people, and it's awful. It's really awful.
And there are 5 people living in Brendan's house, so he had this advice to offer.
I do think it's going to be interesting to see what happens as the weeks go on. Like, we're great, the weather's lovely, the daffodils out and stuff like that at the moment. But at some point the rain is going to hit and it'll get darker and we'll still have to look at one another across the table a little bit too often. It's going to be very difficult to stay kind and stay... Like, I think we're doing great at the moment, but we're going to have to... really batten down the hatches in terms of... Like, I think it's about trying to make decisions to be kind as against feeling that anybody deserves it.
So be kinder than we need to be. OK, we'll have a go. Oh, and don't forget...
Wash your hands.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. In a world where the strange competes only with the surreal and scary for watchword of the day, this week's lyric feature made a magnificent virtue of it. It was called Aishteach, the Irish word for strange, and delved into the avant-garde archive of Ireland. Vascama man Cuivín Branach was an artist who created something known as a subliminal tape series. He recorded found sounds on cassettes and then sometimes burned or buried them. Here's composer Jennifer Walsh.
He was very interested in
manipulating the cassettes as physical objects. So sometimes he would bury them according to periods in the astronomical calendar that he felt had certain portents or certain meaning for him. He would also dig holes in the field and bury the cassettes just with like different objects wrapped around them to sort of infuse them. He would do things like expose them to different odors or smokes or times of the day. But the whole point was that the sounds on the tape would somehow be changed through these sort of magical occult processes, so that when you listen to these sounds or you were in proximity to them, even to the tapes as physical objects, they'd have a healing effect. They'd have some sort of effect on your psyche or on your biology. So it was his own system that he developed of correspondences. It's quite arcane. It's difficult to unpick exactly what he thought was happening, as difficult as many alchemical or occultist or magical systems.
Wearing loose, comfortable, warm clothing.
This is Subliminal Tape 86.
Lie down flat on your back and relax.
But this is just the sonic part of it. The other part is the cassette itself, the material half of the artwork, which Branagh called the sonic object. By subjecting the cassette to the environment, Branagh's concept was to create a symbiosis between nature and sound. It was a highly original process in the Irish art making of the time.
Tom Rosengrave with the lyric feature Aishchuk, a really fascinating programme. And saying slightly on topic, at least geographically.
What is this? Mike and Roscommon. It's always worth reading texts from Roscommon because it'll be always something a bit mad. I was looking for some yeast for my septic tank but cannot find it anywhere with all these mad yolks cooking. So there's a shortage of yeast there in Roscommon for the septic tank, right? So it obviously does its thing. Who knew yeast was so useful? I mean, it's obviously, it creates the bubbles in champagne. I think someone describes it as like yeast farting. That's what champagne, it's not carbonated. It's, yeah, that's so enjoy champagne. It's basically yeast, which is a live microbe farting away.
Beautiful, Oliver Callan. But if there is a yeast shortage, well, we all know who to blame. Ray's sourdough starter, Darcy.
So prep time for sourdough starter, 5 minutes. Right, and you're going, wow, 5 minutes, I have 5 minutes. Fermentation time, 7 days. Total time, 7 days and 5 minutes.
Well, this rather long gestation period is causing some friction, Shay Darcy.
She doesn't like the jar and its contents sitting on the counter in the kitchen. She goes, that's sickening me. Do you have to do that? Do you really have to do that? She said to me today. I said, you're joking, aren't you? It's just a bit of diversion. Just a bit of diversion. And she says, no, I'm sort of going to puke now if you keep doing that. But we worked it out. We cut each other a bit of slack, and that's what we all have to do at this time.
So where's the jar? That's what I want to know. However, all of this prompted Ray to some philosophical staring into the far field.
I was just thinking about that word, diversion. And it's a sort of an Irish word for distraction. And I've had these chats over the years about life, and that a lot of things in life are just as distract us from the passing of time. And that's been brought into very sharp focus now, isn't it? Because all of those things that we use to distract ourselves aren't available to us anymore. So we can't go shopping. We can't play sports in groups. We can't go to the cinema. We can't visit other people. So we're left to our own devices. And we're going to find out an awful lot about ourselves by the end of this. We'll find out, you know, what makes us tick, what makes us happy, what makes us bored, what excites us. We might find out that we're very good on the piano. We might find out that we like reading when we didn't like reading before. We might find out that we're good bakers. We might find out that the person we're living with isn't the person for us. We might reignite a relationship. And it might be just the tonic to spend quality time with the person we've lived with for years and years and years, but because we were busy doing all those things that distract us, work and shopping and sport and all those things, we haven't looked at this person in a long time in the way we looked at them when we first met them. And all of that is good. All of that is positive. And we have to mind each other and we have to cut each other slack. Hugely important, because this is going to go on for another while. And, you know, we need to keep ourselves well mentally. as well as physically, of course. And we know all the things we have to do to keep ourselves well physically. And they involve cocooning for the over 70s, social distancing, washing our hands, coughing into our elbow, all of those things we know. It's not as straightforward to keep ourselves mentally well because we all live inside our own heads. So be careful out there. Mind yourselves.
All very true and lovely. But what about the jar, the smelly jar sitting on the counter?
At the end of it all, I hope I will have a lovely loaf of sourdough bread, which I'll photograph and post on every social media platform available to me.
Darcy. Meanwhile, on Arena. Sean Rocks was joined by John Kenny to celebrate 50 years of Ozzy and Black Sabbath.
Titles like Paranoid, Warning was the final song on the debut album, and even using Black Sabbath. You know, again, to what extent did all of this satanic side of things and negative side of things, did that really upset the older generation and the critics of the day?
The critics of the day, actually, funny enough, Rolling Stone album guide, quote unquoting here, called it stoned out, dumb, clumsy, soulless, over-amplified, ugly. Surely rock was sinking to an all-time low with the satanic claptrap. But the more that the critics dismissed it, the more the fans loved it. It was a shake-up, and a shake-up for the boring. And I think by the 1970s, for me personally, I think we were getting in to the best decade of music. You had a really a lot of genres of music which were all sitting pretty together, and metal, the likes of disco, punk, reggae, all were out there, and a lot of music like the metal stuff was designed to shock. Funny enough though, New York Times in 92 reported that Ozzy was a practicing member of the Church of England and he prayed before every show. So is that courage and convictions myself?
Yeah, again, the satanic thing, there'd have to be big questions around the satanic thing and how much was it just there put there to annoy people. But I'm wondering, even in terms of music...
But isn't that what music's supposed to do? It's supposed to annoy the older generation. So
it is. Possibly it's supposed
to, you know, what are you listening to there, son? You know, it is supposed to annoy the older generation. That's why I say I grew up in the 70s and my thing was punk, and it used to annoy the hell out of everybody, and I thought it was great.
A bit of metal to perhaps channel all our pent-up energy. That was John Kenny on Black Sabbath on Arena. I don't know how you're all filling the time, but for the parents of Molly O'Cahon, well, every day is showtime. Molly is a set and costume designer based in London, but she's now living back in the family home. And she told Oliver Callan how she's playing dress-up with Mammy and Daddy.
Well, in the evenings, I've been trying to keep everyone kind of occupied and busy and stop us from bickering. And so me and my parents have been recreating different portraits from art history and taking photographs on my phone and putting them on Instagram, which I thought would amuse some of my friends because I was a bit bored, and then seems to have brought a lot of people some joy, which is kind of nice.
And they're instantly recognisable, legendary pieces of art, really, aren't they?
Yeah, they're different kind of bits of iconography from across different parts of art history that I sort of realised had two people in them. And it might be fun to photograph my parents in. And of
course, tell us your parents' names.
Liz and Brian.
Liz and Brian. So they've been kind of posing. They've been your putty in your hands.
My models, yeah. And they're my collaborators. We're doing it together. So we've been digging around the cupboards looking for things and going, what would look like this? And how do we make one of these? And the other night my dad showed up with, we needed a sword for something. And he went away for a bit. Oh, went a bit quiet. And then he came back with a piece of wardrobe and a kitchen knife and a spanner that he'd sort of set a tape together and went, this is the perfect sword. And it kind of was.
So American Gothic is the one that really stood out. I thought, like, wow, you know exactly what it is the minute you see it. Can you describe it to people who may not be familiar just by title?
It is a famous American portrait of two people standing side by side outside American, it could be a church or a house, sort of clapboard.
There's an Amish look about it, but your parents are there and they're recreating with their stoic faces.
Yes, They're very good at doing stoic faces. They've gotten good at it. My dad's wearing my mum's glasses in that photo, which I think is quite funny.
Okay. And you can't really tell if they're doing it because it's like, oh, would Molly ever stop and make us do this?
Very possibly. I think they might be getting sick of me at times. But for the most part, I think it's keeping the mood up and spirits light, and they're enjoying it as well.
Oh, we might have to double check that one with the O'Cahan parents, but that was set in costume designer Molly with Oliver. Creativity, culture and nature have all come to the fore in the last few weeks, and even the hardened news hacks are showing their soft underbelly. On Thursday, nature writer Robert McFarlane spoke to Audrey Carville on Morning Ireland, yes, Morning Ireland, about finding solace in nature.
Birdsong, suddenly. Actually, it's not... there are no more birds than there were 3 weeks ago, but with no planes, no cars, suddenly birdsong is bright again and strong on the ear. The cost of this unmasking is terrible. We're measuring it all in our hearts, every one of us. But there is a consolation here. Spring is breaking over us as COVID-19 breaks over us. And I'm so grateful that spring is here to help us through this a little.
Well, that's it. We do live in a wonderful world, and we're seeing that more and more with spring in abundance outside our doors and windows at the moment. And that nature does bring consolation at this very difficult time.
It does. I think of it as anchor points is the way I've been thinking. We're in such chaos where everyone's life is in turbulence, and yet nature is proceeding according to its seasonal rhythms, as it always has done. As the birds' spring migration is happening, the blackthorn is blossoming in the hedgerows, the willow catkins are showing their flowers. These are recognizable points that we've lived with, sometimes without seeing them, throughout our lives, and suddenly they're there, and they seem much more valuable still points and anchor points amid the storm.
That's so beautiful. That was Robert McFarlane on Morning Ireland. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.